And then the fateful day in November.
You're talking about November 22nd, 1963.
Yeah.
When John Fitzgerald Kennedy, our 35th president, was assassinated at 12:30 Central Standard Time.
Yep.
12:30 p.m.
You know, the doctors were working so hard. I was so tired. And then you get about 8 hours sleep and you go back. And you got to do this and you got to do that. And we knew the president was coming to Texas, but who cared? You know, we didn't care a thing about that. And we were up in the clinic doing our work. And Dr. James Carrico, Jim Carrico, actually was an intern with me, but he dropped out a year to do some research and he came back. And he was my junior resident. We flipped a coin. One guy had a good job, the other had a bad job. So the bad job was to go to the emergency room and work on three patients down there that we had to go see. And then the good job was just see some patient on the rounds. I won. So I said, I'm going to see the patients upstairs. Carrico had to go to the emergency room. That's why, if you read the Warren Commission reports, Dr. Carrico was the surgeon in the emergency room that day. So the radio goes off, the paging system, it was overhead. And this thing said, Dr. Shire, stat, Dr. Shire, stat, that's emergency. So I picked up a telephone and said, Betty, Dr. Shire's in Galveston, Texas, talking to the Western Surgical Society. What you got? She said, I don't know. Some guy's been shot downtown. They're bringing him out. They said they needed some surgeons down there in the emergency room. So I walked down there and went to the room door, and there was my junior resident, Carrico, standing up with the lady in the pink dress and the pink pill hat on. I said, you need help in here, Jim? And he, around his back, put a thumbs down on it. But he said the guy across the hallway needs help, and that was Governor Connally.
So you went to his attention to
yeah.
take care of him. What did you observe there?
Well, he had wounds. He had a big chest wound. He had an arm wound. He had a leg wound, where the one bullet supposedly went through all of them.
And you performed surgery?
We did emergency resuscitation on him down in the emergency room. Then he had to go up to surgery. When we got him up there, see, we were all just, you know, we weren't considered full-time doctors yet. There was just a bunch of residents floating around. And this Red Duke guy was the resident then on chest surgery. So he comes into the room. He said, we'll take care of him. I said, Red, what are we going to do? We don't have a professor here. What are we going to do? And he said, partner, if we can saddle him, we can ride him. Typical Texan. Anyhow, luckily, Dr. Robert Shaw, who was a giant in the thoracic surgery world, came in and said, Governor Connally, this is Bob Shaw. I'm here to take care of you. And so he said, oh, Dr. Shaw, thank you for coming over. And that took the sweat off of us. He was the actual surgeon at the table and everything on Dr. Connally.
So your role then was just to make sure he was stabilized.
Stabilized, yeah.
And then they moved off to surgery.
Yeah.
Did you see John Kennedy at all, his body?
Yes, I saw him, but Carrico was standing there with the lady in front of him. He was talking to her, and the body was over here on the other side.
Would that have been Jacqueline Kennedy that he was talking to?
Mm-hmm.
And you saw the body off to the side, and there was nothing else they could do, obviously.
There was nothing. There was no resuscitation attempt going on.
When is the enormity of this hitting you? I mean,
I didn't even know who the man was.
That body?
Yeah.
You didn't realize that was the president?
No, I didn't even know that was Governor Connally until Dr. Shaw said.
So at that point you didn't, but then...
You know, the residents still had the three patients in emergency room we had to take care of. So we took care of them.
I'm still taken with the fact you saw this body and you didn't know who it was, and here it was, the 35th president of the United States.
Actually, when I walked in that room, I did not know. And I did not know. I had a thought after, when we were working with Connally, with his wounds, the door opened up and the lady in the pink dress came in and said, how is he doing? Duke said, not very well, ma'am. She said, well, we'll pray for him. And then she left the room.
And that was Jacqueline
Kennedy. And then I could tell because she was now looking my way. See, before she was looking at Carrico's face. So anyhow, that's...
Was that the moment then you knew that that was JFK's body you looked at?
I tell you, when things really dawned on me, there was an elevator at Parkland. It went from the emergency room up to the first floor, then surgery's on the second floor. All of a sudden, the trap door in the roof of that elevator was open, and there was a state highway cop up in there with a machine gun. Honest to God, it was the first time that it really hit me that this was something really serious. And then there was a NBC news reporter that was always, I mean, he was always literally touching your body. He didn't know anybody, but he'd ask everybody, is there any news, or is there any news, or is there any news? And he was very much in your face and bothersome.
So then as investigations continued, you had no idea about John Connally, how many bullets or where the bullets went and all that.
It was just
to make sure he was stabilized, and then they moved on. Lots of controversy, of course, as we know about all that. But
it was interesting because Governor Connally lived. Governor Connally had his ups and downs, and Red Duke was actually a Baptist minister before he became a doctor. He was a big game hunter. Anyhow, he would take his slides of hunting in Africa to the hospital room of Governor Connally and show them on the wall and say, what do you think about that, Governor? Then the next minute he said, now, Governor, you got some pus in your lungs. We've got to put a red tube down your nose into your lungs and suck it out. And then the next minute he'd be praying over him. The people at Parkland are absolutely incredible people. So he's still alive. He's probably 85, 86. He's at Lyndon Baines Johns Hospital down in Houston, the head of trauma department, makes rounds with a dog. Unheard of.
So then you were up in John Connolly's room and in and out of there every once in a while?
Yeah. But then we worked 36 hours on and we off. So that was my Friday. And then so the next day, you know, we worked through Saturday till 6 o'clock or so. And then I went home and had to talk to my wife. People were calling my house and I had to go to bed. I got to bed and went back to work the next day. And it was sitting there with head of neurosurgery at Parkland, Southwestern Medical School. And he had a visitor in town from University of Michigan, a professor. And there was a couple of others. I was sitting there drinking coffee. We'd finished rounds. We were in the surgery office kind of thing. They had coffee there. And the recovery room was here. Connally was still there, and we were over here just visiting. And Mrs. Connally would stop by the door and say, thank you very much, and then she'd leave. So Dr. Kemp Clark was in there. He was the professor of surgery. The phone rings, and I go pick it up, and it's a student. I said, hello, this is surgery office. And the boy says, who is this? I said, this is Jerry Gustafson. Who am I talking to? He said, this is Fred. I'm the jail doctor. He said, Jack Ruby just shot Oswald, and we're bringing him out to Parkland. So I said, okay, Fred, thanks a lot. So I turned. I said, hey, guys, this is crazy. Oswald just been shot. So they put a big emergency crisis thing. Everybody goes to the emergency room. Duke was in the building. He was down there. And he rolls in. We start IVs on this guy.
On Oswald.
Oswald, yeah. Because I'm back to being the trauma admitting doctor that day. We get him resuscitated. By this time, Dr. Shires had been brought back from Galveston. He had been flown back after Kennedy's body had left. They brought him right back. He came in an Air Force fighter jet, I heard. He was in town, and he was immediately over there. So he assumed the duty there. He and Dr. Mac Perry and Dr. McClellan and Baxter and those senior people, they took that over, and then he didn't make it.
Oswald did not make it.
No.
How long did he live from the time you saw him there?
Oh, I imagine an hour.
You could tell immediately that he wasn't going to make this. He was shot where?
I talked to the top security guards that day, and I said, what about that gunshot? And they all said, it's a commando shot. And I didn't know what that was. So I said, what's a commando shot? He said, he was shot with a gun that didn't have a hammer on it. So you can't reach over and stop the hammer from coming down. Second thing is, take a look at the pictures. He was grabbed by the arm, and he was turned sideways and shot from the side. Because the square footage of the target is great if you look from the front, but it really narrows if you look from the side. Everybody said, this is a professional killing. And I just sat there with my mouth open in awe because all these people seemed to know what they were talking about. I was just a dumb surgeon trying to help out. My job, when Oswald was in the operating room of all things, the chief of homicide was up there, Will Fritz. We dealt in a lot of deaths at Parkland, a lot of gunshot loss, a lot of trauma. And so we knew people like chief of homicide, and he knew who I was. And the hallway was sort of like a cross. The elevator's coming up. But the operating room was down one of these hallways. He said, you stand here and you don't let anybody come down this hallway that you don't know. He had an armed officer there with me. I went out to call the operating room to tell him that we have to bring a gunshot wound up, and it's Lee Harvey Oswald, and prepare for chest surgery and abdominal surgery. So I went out to get on the phone, and all the phones were busy. The other night, Robert Caro talked about when they brought LBJ from the hospital to the airport, nobody knew where he was in the United States. There wasn't any communications. Well, when I went out there, there was a guy talking on the telephone with four stars on his shoulder in an Air Force uniform. He was talking about SAC being scrambled. And he had, you know, the box and everything in front of him. We'd seen movies about that. So I knew that they were really suspecting big-time stuff.
Let me just say, Robert Caro was in town at the University of Tulsa speaking, and he'd written a book about LBJ.
Four volumes of LBJ history.
And that's what you attended. You made reference.
Everything else Mr. Caro said was absolutely on mark. I'm sure that Air Force officer went with the president back to the Air Force One. I'm sure he did. And they knew where he was. Well, anyhow, a thing has come up that's been very controversial about the whole thing and his body leaving. It came up again last year when a good friend of mine, Earl Rose, died up in Iowa. Dr. Rose was the medical examiner of Dallas County at the time. He came to the emergency room, and they prepared to bring the president out and take him back to the airport. And Dr. Rose stood in front of the door and said, something to this extent. I didn't have a tape recorder. This was the president of the United States. He is now a murder victim in Dallas County, Texas. And he is in my domain to do a medical legal examination. Those guys just jumped him and threw him to the floor, got him out of the way in front of Mrs. Kennedy, and they just hauled that body right on out.
So that's how that happened.
Yeah. That's in the press. You know, that's in the articles and everything. He was the guy with the arms in front of the door. And he was a marvelous, marvelous doctor and a marvelous person. He was from an Indian reservation in South Dakota. He had gone to medical school in Iowa, and had gone to law school and became a forensic pathologist. Dallas did not have medical examiners until the summer of 1963, and he was our first one. He was academically inclined, and he would come to the operating rooms and see our problems. He would call us to come to his lab to see his problems. A wonderful, wonderful guy.
There's a point where the federal authorities overruled the local physically, literally.
Physically.
And just threw him to the side and took that body to Washington,
D.C. That's right. That's right. Another funny thing, I can't tell you who did it or anything, I don't want to say that, but when the motorcade arrived, the squawk box went off and said, "Need a gurney on the dock, gurney on the dock." That language means some lady's having a baby in the car, get a stretcher, you know, what they call a precip tray, and get out the back door quick. So a resident grabbed the thing and went out the back door. When he got out there, here was a man in a convertible with a headshot. He was stunned. And so he came back in and said, "I don't know what's going on. There's a gunshot to the head out there in a big car." But he said, "It looked like I walked by LBJ on the way out." And he said there was two people holding him up, carrying him in. Mr. Carroll mentioned that. Talked about Rufus Youngblood, who was a Secret Service agent that threw his body over him. And he said, "We got to take him to a safe place." And the highway patrolman driving the car knew that Parkland would be as safe as anything. So he just drove him right in there. But LBJ entered the hospital first. So everybody said, "Well, what, did he have a heart attack? What's going on? You know, why'd they haul him in there?" So this was explained. Mr. Youngblood explained why they brought him there and hid him away in what was called minor medicine. It was a section of three rooms where they'd see people for sore throats. And as soon as it calmed down, they pulled him out.
At some time, this had to all sink in on you and all your friends.
Well, you know, a lot of people, there's always humor and tragedy. And certain people were really sad that Jack Ruby was arrested, because Jack Ruby ran two nightclubs. One of them was called the Merry-Go-Round over on Lemon Avenue, the Oak Lawn and Lemon area. We would be working at night. There was a great big black orderly named Big Earl, and Big Earl would say, "Food orders, food orders." We'd say, "Give me a hamburger and fries and so." And he'd take these big food things over, and Jack Ruby was just instructions. Anytime the Parkland Emergency Room wanted food, just give it to him. And so, where are we going to get our hamburgers now at 1 o'clock in the morning?
This is so well documented, but you have given us your eyewitness, what you saw.
Yeah. I will tell you that people have been down to the museum, and they've told me that I had to go down, had to go down. And believe it or not, my wife and I did not go see the museum till last summer.
How did that affect you?
It was just like deja vu. It was just like all over again. You know, I just could see all that stuff.
Did you have any dreams about it later on?
No. I think that once you go over the line and become a surgeon, you see so much horrible stuff. I mean, it's just horrible.
So that, to take the emotion out of it, that was one of many.
I guess you can just repress it or something. I will tell you, I'm quite disappointed with the Marine Corps pathologist that did the three autopsies, at least.
The autopsy on JFK.
Yeah, and never came to a conclusion. After the first one, they burned all their papers, which was kind of unique, and it left them without any conclusion. They're still arguing about the bullet coming from the front or the back and all this stuff.
Whether four bullets were actually fired or three. And from the grassy knoll was the one up there, and we still don't know.
Nobody knows.
And up until 2003, there was a very high percentage of Americans, I think it was 60 or 70%, felt there still was a conspiracy of some sort.
I think the generations have moved on, and people don't even know what happened, you know. But I think today, people in certain age groups would still believe it's a conspiracy.
Yeah.